Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic. As you probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Everybody, welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens from theathletic.com. I am Marc-Antoine Godin, alongside Arpin Basu, confined still at home on this beautiful Friday, May the 1st. Sorry about that. You know, it's been a long time, Arpin.
Yes, it has. It has. March the 1st seems like 5 years ago, but anyway.
Yeah. No kidding. Yeah, I know. But although April has gone quicker than March did. So at least I feel like there's a, I don't know if it's just because we've got accustomed to this new reality, but at least I feel like times have passed as a normal rate since that endless March that we lived. So
yeah,
Arpin, we have a guest today,
a very special guest who has decided to join us, agreed to join us. Taking away from his busy schedule is Sergio Mimeso. Thanks for joining us, Sergio. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
We're great, man. We're great. Thanks for being with us. It's an honor to have you on, cause we're colleagues because obviously you're working, as a colorman on the radio for the Canadiens games, on TSN 690. But also you're a former Montreal Canadian. So as we, I don't want to make you older than you are, but growing up, I remember you with the Canadiens jersey on some epic moments that you lived with the Canadiens. So it's fun to have you both as a colleague and as a former player too. So thanks for being with us.
No problem, guys. No problem.
Well, first off, what are you up to these days, man?
Well, you know, it was a good time to start working on the house. And I think a lot of us, you know, I talked to my neighbors on the phone and everyone's working in the garage or working, in the house. So I've been painting. I've been doing stuff. I've done stuff that I never thought I'd do. I did some drywall downstairs because there was holes in the wall from when my kids were young. They were playing hockey down in the basement. I used to keep it for them so they can play hockey when they were young. So I decided to fix all the holes that were down there. There was a few body checks going on in the basement okay. back in the day. Been doing that a lot and worked my way upstairs and started working, doing some more painting in the family room and the kitchen. And now we've gone to the garage and the shed. So there's a lot of stuff to do, at home and kind of got to those things that never really got to, because we'd be still traveling around pretty much or, just starting to, to get the spring, into action. So I've taken advantage at least of doing a lot of stuff around the house, of course.
Right.
Sergio, one thing I've always wanted to ask you, I've listened to you guys, sometimes when you're on the road and I'm not on the trip, I'll catch you guys on the radio. And I just, as a former Canadian, you still seem to take the performance of the team to heart to a certain extent. Like, how do you broadcast these games when, you do have, a certain allegiance to this team? Yeah. What's it like to, do you have to try and keep that in check or do you use that as fuel for your analysis or your commentary on the game?
Well, I have to say I try to be as fair as possible. I know that there's other broadcasts that are really, for the home team and I get it. They don't work maybe for a station. They kind of get paid by the team. We get paid by TSN, yes, but I'm still traveling with the team. So I understand the fine line. I can't say I get in too far into details about, this trade or, that was a bad trade or that was a bad move. I try not to get into that. I just try to bring what I see in the game, whether, that was a good play or not. And I'll definitely mention when players are playing well, but I'll definitely say it when players are not playing well. And I don't have a problem with someone going through a struggle or they might be going through a slump because I know what it's like. And sometimes, especially in Montreal, when it gets longer and you keep have to answer those questions, it is tough for a player. So I kind of get it on that side. But I will get on someone if I don't see at least the effort or the caring about winning. And, so that's, I try to say that. And yeah, for sure, it's a lot more fun, and I'm sure with you guys too, to ask questions when the team is winning and when they're losing and when they're going through streaks of what we've gone through a few years past. Yes, last year, the year before, this year was a comeback kind of thing, and then this year was tough again. And it is tough to broadcast games when people are. Maybe not as enthusiastic and there's a lot of negativity. So, it is tough. And listen, I want to watch playoff games too, here in Montreal, doing the games at the Bell Center or going on the road with the team in the playoffs. It is fun to do the games. I'm realistic. I know that, you have to have a lot more elements to go far and to win a cup, but it is fun just to be in the playoff atmosphere, and it is a little frustrating to watch, for sure, as a former player. We all have pride. We all want to be in the playoffs, and it gets a little tough to watch sometimes when you're not in the playoffs because you definitely, even as a broadcaster, you still there's a little bit of it's still in you a little bit that you want to see the team win.
How often do you hear from players that that will say, you said this or that about me? Do you get any feedback from the players at all?
Actually, I don't think I've ever had one come up to me and tell me something. Honest to God, maybe they're afraid of me. I don't know.
But it should be.
I haven't heard anybody really say anything, to be honest. No one has come up to me and said, you shouldn't have said that or you went too far. I think it's more the talk shows or, at the station than the broadcasts. And I'm not sure if the guys are, they're playing the game, so they're not listening to the broadcast. And yeah, maybe there will be parts of it on the radio, you know, played out after as a clip that they might hear. But I haven't had anybody said anything to me. No.
Well, that's good. I think they are probably a little bit afraid of you as you're kind of lurking around on the road, and you sort of. I like your, because you know you don't have to go and get stuff from players necessarily, you know, before the game or what have you, and I just, you know, I look at you with envy sometimes when we're on the road and be like, man, that'd be nice to just kind of hang out and lay low in the weeds and sort of pick your spots with guys. But do you talk to the players all that much or not so much?
I try to pick my spots, like you say. In the dressing rooms, there's so many media, as you guys know, and you're right. I am lucky. I'm in a position where I see you guys have to get in there and run down to the room to get your info. And I know that the players don't, especially when they're losing, they don't want to talk to the media. So I don't envy your position. That's for sure. No, it's true. And for me, yeah, you could see Dan and I a little bit looser, because we're still doing the broadcast. We're still trying to enjoy it. As you know, but I do talk to the players a little bit more on the side where I wouldn't see many of you, at the airport, at the hotels. And I really don't try to bother them more than, you know, much. It's more of a friendly thing and, sort of, you know, I'll ask them some questions here and there, but try not to get too in depth in things. But, you won't see me as much inside those scrums, but I do see them more as, because we're privileged a little bit to travel with them. So we get to see them a little bit on their own without a lot of media around. So they're a little bit more comfortable in that mm-hmm. situation. Mm-hmm. So some guys will open up a little bit more.
Hey, Sergio, I'm wondering, were you a good interview when you were a player?
I'm not sure. I think I was, yeah. Why?
Oh, I'm curious. I don't know, because you're a good storyteller, and you like, you know, I like, you know, we chat before games often at the Bell Center, and I've always wondered if, you know, but I've heard you say on numerous occasions how the whole media player exchange can be unpleasant. I was just wondering, like, in your experience in Montreal in particular, like, were you a guy who was really open with the media, or did you kind of resent them being around, or what was your view on that?
You know, as a kid, when you first come in here, all the big guys are getting the questions, obviously, and they're going to ask you about being a rookie and stuff like that. So there's not much pressure on you. So it's kind of, mm-hmm. and Montreal is tough. There's no question. So if things did go sour, I wasn't really the guy that was going to take the heat at the time. So you kind of get sheltered from that. So I didn't mind it. I know that I got a lot of requests to go on the French media because I could speak French. So mm-hmm. I got more interviews than the other guys like Jim Corson or whatever, the guys that didn't speak French. So I did in English and in French. So there was always a story around myself because I was from Montreal. It was a big deal that, you know, I came from an Italian heritage, which wasn't many Italian players that played for Montreal. So that was a bit of a story. You know, so there was stuff going on. Of course, I had a big injury. And when I first came in my first year, so I didn't mind doing interviews, to be honest. I think St. Louis was very easy as I moved on there. There wasn't many you know, guys covering the Blues, especially in the time that I was there in 88, 89, and those years, I think we had two guys that would follow the team. And one guy came from the baseball, from the Cardinals.
Ah, okay.
And I think the first game I scored a goal. And after the game, he came to ask me a question. He says, you know that you're on pace for, at the time, I think it was 80 games. You're on pace for 80 goals this year. And I said, it doesn't work that way. I said, I probably won't score for another four games. I said, I'm in the 20 to 25 range, so don't expect me to score every game. I tried to tell him jokingly. He was a nice guy. Dave Luking was his name. Dave, I said, Dave, it's like in baseball. If I go 4-for-4 in the first game, I'm not going to bat 1,000 the whole year. But he kind of laughed and chuckled, and he always used to come up and see me later on in the year and joke about that first question. It was different. It was different. Even when I played for Montreal, a lot of the guys would travel with us. Even when we had, if we chartered, we didn't charter as much, but sometimes we did with the Canadians. With St. Louis, never. We were flying the old TWA terminal there, and out of St. Louis, okay. And it was pretty scary at times. But anyway, we the guys would travel with us, and they would we'd see them on the road, and sometimes we'd invite them over for a drink or whatever because they were alone. Basically, now that when I travel, you see all the guys. You guys are about 40. Between the TV and the French and the English and all the different writers and radio. So they have a crew that you guys hang out with, right? When you're on the road. And back then they were kind of on their own, one or two guys. And we used to buy them a beer and stuff like that. It was no big deal. It was a lot different. We didn't feel, that it was that heavy, especially down in St. Louis. It was totally different. When people say, how come the guy's playing better when he's over there and how come he didn't play as well, let's say, in a Canadian city? Well, a lot of times it's just you get to play your game and then you do your thing. And sometimes for some players, that's the best thing for them. They don't have to really handle so much pressure, and some people can handle it, some people can't.
How would you compare your experience in Vancouver to Montreal? Because you talk about a Canadian, the Canadian aspect, and I think Vancouver's just as intense a media market as over here. But was it more or less? What was it like for you
in Vancouver?
I
think it was all good, because when I got traded from St. Louis, it was a really big trade, and it was four of us that went there: Cliff Ronning, myself, and Jeff Cortinel, and Robert Dirk, who was an extra big defenseman. But we were kind of at the stage in Vancouver. They were bad for so many years that they were finally turning it around. And I think everybody was just excited. And then the year after, they got Pavel Bure to come, who they drafted. He finally came over and legitimately gave us a superstar player to put us over the top to be one of the best teams out west. So it was a great time. I was just lucky. I hit it in stride where there was nothing really to complain about, because every year this team was getting better, and the fans were getting more excited to watch a team that had a chance to win, where over the years before they were, they can never have a chance against Edmonton or Calgary and those type of teams. So it was actually a really great I was sometimes in the right spot, you come in and everything kind of goes well. Those are good memories where we were, a lot of us mentioned before, we were 26, 27. We're all in that age where you get to play your best hockey, where you've played 5 or 6 years in the NHL. You've gained experience. You've gotten stronger. You're playing a lot of minutes. I became an assistant captain in Vancouver with Pat Quinn. And we went to the final that year against the Rangers, and we were a goal away to winning the cup. So there was a lot of positives. Two of my kids were born in Vancouver in 93 and 94. And I'll tell you a good story. In 94, my daughter was born April 30th, 94. And why that story comes up again, it's because April 30th was yesterday, and we had her birthday here at the house. And we have an old video, and we show her photos and stuff. And actually, Dave Randorf, who does the games now for Sportsnet, he came to the house and interviewed us back in the day when he was working for a local TV station. After she was born. And it was a big story then. What happened is, on the 30th of April, my wife, I was in Calgary for Game 7. And that night, I said goodnight to her at 11 o'clock, and then at 8 in the morning, she calls me and she says, we had a baby girl. And I said, well, wait a second. I just talked to you. Yeah. I went to the hospital, in the middle of the night, and we had the baby.
That was fast.
Game 7 at 8 in the morning. I'm in Calgary. She was 2 weeks early, but, her parents came over to help out in case. So she wasn't alone, of course, because I was on the road. And if we lost the game, we would have flew back to Vancouver. and I would have seen my daughter later that night. But if we, so I didn't see the birth of my daughter. I saw the birth of my son in 93, but this was, I was in Calgary for game seven, so we didn't know when she was going to be born. She was born in the middle of the night. We ended up winning game seven. We flew to Dallas right away because we played them in the next round, and we played the first two games there. We won the first game there, and then in the middle of the first and second game, Pat Quinn came with me to buy cigars because I had to buy cigars for the boys because my daughter was born, because he used to love his cigars. So, you know, just to tell you how cool this guy was, he was the president, the GM, and the coach. And we went out together to buy cigars, and I wasn't really a cigar guy. And he said, these would be fine. So I bought a few boxes for everyone. We went, we had a practice the next day, the in between the games. And he stood up in the dressing room and said, boys, and I handed out cigars to everybody. He goes, I know a lot of you don't smoke, but we have to just light up the cigar for Mo, for Mo's daughter being born. And after that, you could just put it out. But it's just, you know, we just want to say, you know, congratulations for having his daughter. So I thought that was pretty cool. And it was kind of funny because everyone lit up a cigar. Everybody lit up a cigar in the dressing room. So we just had our skates off. We just finished practice. Then the media came in, and then it was a wall of smoke, right? And yeah. This was at the old Dallas, what was it called, the Reunion Arena, I think it was?
Yeah, Reunion, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and it just stunk of cigar. And every all the newspaper guys or the reporters were like, what happened here? Like, you know, you guys are still a long way from winning the cup. And we were like, no, we're celebrating Mo's daughter. We had to have a cigar. But it was very casual. No one made a big, like, it was a nice story. It wasn't like a story, oh, my God, those guys are smoking a cigar and they shouldn't be doing that, or they're cocky now because they think they're going to win. It had nothing to do with that. It was just a it was a good man that, you know, just had the respect of – that's why we love playing for him, because it wasn't just about hockey. It was also about life. In that moment, it was a good day off in between games that we kind of took it in. And we won the next game, and we're up two, and I scored a big goal in the game four. It was an overtime goal against Dallas, and we ended up beating them in five. And so it became a good story that my daughter was born on game seven, and she became kind of like the good luck charm during that run in 94.
Wow.
So it was weird, and a lot of stuff on Twitter now, they're showing the old games, like of 94 and this and that. And so it reminds me of that run that we had. But it was also the team that we had, and all the people that – it wasn't just on the ice. It was a lot of stuff going on off the ice, and I thought that was kind of cool.
So it's funny you tell that story, Sergio, because it seems that I remember a year not so long ago where the Canadians were about to enter the playoffs, and there were – I think there must have been two or three guys on the team – that were about to have kids during the playoffs. And I was working at La Presse back then, and we were exactly in the same situation. We had two or three guys at La Presse that were saying, that were secretly hoping that the Canadians would not go far in the playoffs because they would have to deal with, you know, having a newborn at home. So it must be a tricky situation. I mean, during the regular season, we see it. Players say, okay, well, they're going to take a short leave of absence, a day or two, until they can, just so that they can enjoy the birth of their son or daughter. But during the playoffs, it might be a lot trickier, isn't it?
It is, man. I mean, what the teams were doing, and even in St. Louis, I didn't have kids, but at that time, you know, the teams would have a hotel for half a day, a day room in the middle of the day at home games too. When you're on the road, I mean, I used to joke to my wife when we had our kids, and we, you know, at the beginning with young kids, nobody sleeps. I'd go on the roads and I couldn't wait to get on the road so I could sleep and get to the hotel and just lie down and get a good night's sleep. And as everyone knows, when they have kids in the first 6 months or whatever, it's hard. So, yeah, in the playoffs, we used to, you know, teams used to get players rooms for the day, even for the home games, so they could rest and didn't have to hear their kids running around during the day, you know, if they weren't at school or whatever when they were so young. So, yeah, that's what teams would do. And I would always take a day room. I would because, you know, if I could take a nap in the afternoon because our games were 7:30, 8 o'clock or whatever, and keep that energy, you know, we get into a routine. You have your little morning skate, you get back to the hotel, you get something to eat, you go to the room and you relax a bit. Even if you don't sleep, you just, you chill, you watch some TV, and then you go to the game and you kind of get ready for the game, especially in the playoffs. You really want to concentrate. You don't want to have any distractions. Thank God we didn't have any phones back then, you know. And, you know, so now if I contact my nephew, whatever, I never call him between 2 and 5. I know the times when to reach him or just after a morning skate or whatever, because I know that everyone has a routine.
Yeah. Listen, you, obviously, for those who don't, who are not familiar, when you refer to your nephew, obviously, it's Marco Scandella, now playing with, the St. Louis Blues. He signed a new contract recently with the Blues. He must be pretty happy about it. And it's funny because you both played for the Canadians and for the Blues. So it's, it's pretty cool.
It is cool. I told him you're going to love it there. I mean, he played in Minnesota, so he knew the division, but, you know, a lot of people, you know, when you guys, and when everyone comes in, you get into the downtown and you go to the arena and then you get to the airport and you take off and you kind of see St. Louis, but you don't really see it. You know, there's all the places that you visit kind of look the same. There's some cities that you like better, of course.
Yeah.
But when you live in a city, you get to really know the different parts of the city, the different neighborhoods and stuff like that. And there's a big alumni there, as you guys know. A lot of guys ended up staying there because they like the Midwest. It's not hustle and bustle like the East Coast. It's you know, it's not as expensive as Chicago, you know, to get a home or you know, to rent a place. So it's you know, it's a little more affordable, especially in our days. We didn't you know, we're still making good money, but it's not even close, obviously, of the money today. Guys can get whatever they want, but, you know, so, and the people were very friendly, and, you know, so a lot of guys like living there. And I said, you're going to like living there. He didn't have a lot of chance. He was just there at the end, and then obviously this happened. He was obviously very disappointed because of they were playing so well, and he got to play with Parayko, you know, so, I mean, he couldn't land in a better spot to play with that player. I really think this is going to be one of the best defensemen in the league there. So he's like a beast out there. So, you know, he just has to do his job. He talked to Craig Berube, you know, I just want you to clear the net, move the puck, and play well defensively. You don't have to think much. Parayko's going to take care of the rest. And when you play on such a good, solid team, it just makes your job a lot easier. You're not running around trying to do stuff or covering up mistakes on somebody else, or, you know, and if you make a mistake, somebody's going to cover you. So, I mean, he couldn't have landed in a better spot. And to be honest, I didn't think he was going to get 4 years. I thought maybe 3, but 4 was a bonus. And I guess St. Louis didn't want to fool around and wait to see what's going to go on with all the situation here. And they decided to keep him.
I mean, he's really lucky because, like, this is the worst year to be an unrestricted free agent. It's like, absolutely. So I was stunned when I saw the announcement. I was like, why? Because St. Louis, it's not as if they're swimming in money either. They have Petrangelo that they have to get re-signed, and they have a lot of, so I was, he must have really made a quick impression on them, because that was shocking news. Well, when I saw that, I was really surprised.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, he signed a few other players. Sammy Blais there, and mm-hmm. he signed McEachran, I believe. He made a few signings. I guess he wanted to get it done before the uncertainty. They know Bomeister probably not coming back after that, you know, trouble that he had with his heart. And it was weird because we were on the road with the Canadians, and that week we were in Boston, Pittsburgh, and I forget the next town we were supposed to go to after that. A 3-game road trip.
No, that was a 2-game road trip.
It was a 2-game road, and then we came home, right? We went to Detroit. We were in Detroit because he got traded in Detroit. This is, once we're in Pittsburgh, we went out for lunch because there was a day off, and kind of knew that the week before, Marco scored a big goal against Toronto, and then Kovalchuk scored in overtime, and that's when the team was still having the feeling of making a run with Kovalchuk, and then that was a great story. And thank God we had that little story in between, eh, guys?
Yeah, absolutely.
To make it a little bit interesting. And then Yeah, and then reality set in, playing Boston, a real playoff team. Pittsburgh, a real playoff team. And then you can tell that they just couldn't compete against those teams. And it was evident that he was going to get traded, because I spoke to Mark and he said, if we're not going to get this, we're not going to be close, Marco being a free agent, that he was probably going to make a move. And St. Louis was the perfect spot. And I was in Pittsburgh, and I said to Marco, when Bouwmeester went down, I said, that could be the spot. You could be going to St. Louis. There was some obviously other teams that were interested, but it just worked out perfect for him, a left-handed D. And I watched a lot of the games after, in between our games that St. Louis was playing. And they went into a run. I think they went like two or three games where they had three shutouts in a row. Binghamton was amazing. They killed off every penalty. And he was killing penalties with Pareko. And he just arrived at the right time where the team started to play well. And they were just, so the games that he was there was a good time. I think he played 11 games. I think they won 9 of them. So he was plus whatever. And he was playing 20 something minutes, or around 20 minutes a game. So the timing was perfect. When you get traded, you're so pumped up. And he was pumped up to play here in Montreal too. But he was in a unique situation, being a free agent, getting traded twice, which was kind of strange. At different times, the way the contracts are set up, and with free agency and everything. So anyway, it worked out for him. It's great. So we're good. And I got a place to stay now that I'm in St. Louis, so that's perfect for me too.
It was good, the wheeling and dealing from Bergevin, also from the price that he paid to get Marco from Buffalo, and then getting it back. What he received from St. Louis, he was winning that trade, from both ends, giving up a fourth to acquire him and getting a second in return. That was pretty good.
Yeah, and they get a fourth now because he's signed in St. Louis, right?
They get a fourth in 2021. Yeah.
Yeah, plus he gets a second. So he's happy there. To be honest, if he would have got a real contract offer, he might have thought of staying here, but didn't really get it. So it was an easy one that he was going to go to July 1st, but get traded before. And so it all worked out for him. So now we just got to start playing hockey again. So time will tell, but at least he's got that contract in his pocket. And I gave him a lot of areas of where to live and where the guys live and stuff. And I got a lot of friends that are still there. So he's definitely looking forward to look for a place when he gets back there. But obviously he came back because of the situation. He didn't stay in St. Louis. He's in Montreal waiting to see what's happening.
Hey Sergio, I just wanted to pick up on something, in the sense that you were on the 85-86 Canadiens, and they had, you were one of a number of 19-year-old players. I mean, it's pretty remarkable that you guys won. I mean, considering how young you were. The Canadiens now are trying to do something similar, I guess, where there's a group of young players coming in kind of together and growing together. What was the dynamic? Like, I think in theory, everyone sees, you can see that and say, well, that's a good idea. Players will learn to play with each other and they'll develop chemistry and they'll become friends and everything will be great. But is there what are the difficulties? What were the difficulties on that team of doing that, of having like this big group of young players sort of suddenly injecting themselves into, so kind of a veteran team?
Well, I think at the time in 83, 84, the Canadiens were struggling, where they had their great veterans in Gainey and Robinson and, Rick Green. But the middle of the pack guys and their young guys just weren't cutting it. And finally, the draft that they had years before, I got drafted 27th overall. Closing year was 26th. I think the year after Patrick Waugh got drafted, Stéphane Richer, all these guys became NHLers for a very long time. So I mean, even though that once we started playing that season in 85 with these young guys, and they had guys like Brian Skrulin and Mike McPhee that were 23, 24, but they were rookies, but they were coming from the American League.
Right.
And when you had talked about Shel Dalene, who was a very skilled European style player that could score goals. It was a great group of guys that we had. I mean, these were all players that played a long time. Most of them did. Played a lot of years in the NHL. I don't know if that's a group that just didn't hop on the ice to be on the fourth line. These guys were guys that, obviously you don't start on the first line, but you can slide, and Doc and Shane Corson was another one. You can slide them in the third line, the second line, and Claude Lemieux on the first line at some shifts. You saw him on the power play here, Richier on the power play, on the second power play, whatever. They can fit in with Mats Naslin and Bobby Smith, and it was a combination of veterans, and then you had the middle of the pack, guys like Chelios that were up-and-coming star players, besides having Robinson, Ludwig, and Green, and the steady defense. Peter Sobota was another young guy
that
came
19.
In the year before. Yeah, so, I mean, it was a pretty special group of young players, I have to say. So I don't know if, you know, to have that, it's pretty tough. I don't know. If you got guys that are, you know, third and fourth liners, I don't think you're going to do it. But you got to have a mix of guys that could be stars too eventually. And they end up being in their own right. But at the time, and then you got Patrick Waugh, who played unbelievable. I mean, it just seemed like everything hit its stride, right? All these guys were good players in junior. They were all top players in junior. So they all had something, you know, we all did, that we knew how to win. We knew how to put points on the board. We knew how to play the game of hockey. So whether it be skating wise or shooting or toughness, so we had the mix. I don't know how to explain it. It was pretty special. I mean, I got hurt, which in December, and I didn't play the rest of the year, which kind of sucked. And if you guys remember, I don't know if you remember, Claude Lemieux didn't make the team in training camp. He got cut.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He got sent down. I had a better camp. Nobody thought I was going to make the team, but I ended up making the team. Well, I don't know if they thought I was going to make the team. I had a really good camp. I scored a couple goals. I think we went out to Edmonton and played some games out there. Then I got into a couple fights, other games. I knew that if I didn't score one game, I had to show every game that I was doing something. And that's something that players that I kind of say on my broadcast, like when they're in training camp, and I get it. Sometimes my first year in camp at 18 and 19, I think I could have scored, you know, maybe 6 or 7 goals in training camp. I was getting sent back down to junior. I mean, it was in the cards. I remember at 19 years old, I had a great camp and they sent me back. And then I made the team the next year. It was kind of already written in stone that you weren't making the team. But that year, it was wide open. Everybody had a chance because they needed some new players, and everyone hit their stride, and that's what it was. I don't know if we can compare it.
You were mentioning that Shel Dalene earlier, and I wrote a feature on him trying to describe to you know, younger fans what sort of a one-hit wonder he's been. And he, in my article, there's this picture of the group of rookies that you were in for the 85-86 season. It's a wonderful picture because there's about 10 of you guys. So you, and I think you posted that same picture on Twitter a few days ago. So there are two chairs in front of the net, and you've got your skate on one of the two chairs. Shell is sitting on the other chair. You've got Brian Skrulin who's sitting on the ice, like leaning back to the post. Patrick Roy is sitting on top of the net. Right next to him, there's Stéphane Richer. You've got Shane Corson there. You've got, I think it's David Mailey next to Corson. And that other guy that I don't know who it is next to you is the only guy that I haven't really identified. But
it was
amazing.
Mike Lawler.
It's Lawler.
Mike Lawler.
Yeah, okay.
Rooney. And Steve Rooney. Steve Rooney was the other guy, not Mailey.
Yeah, Steve,
it
Steve Rooney.
Oh, it's Rooney. That's
because
it.
Mailey,
okay.
And you noticed Claude Demure wasn't there because I told you he got cut at the beginning of the year. That photo was taken at the beginning of the year. I don't know who took the photo. He kind of said, okay, you stand here, you go here. Put your foot on the chair, and it was kind of a cool photo, actually. You're right. Yeah. It was kind of, and Maley came later, I think, because he finished his college, and then he came after college. He came later on. So, there was, and the thing is, everybody was big. I mean, they're all big guys. It's true. Yeah. I mean, that's the way it was. You know, they used to say we got drafted because for the Adams division, and Church of Arts said we need guys to play, because you had to get out of the Adams division to go somewhere. So that's the way they were drafting big wingers, right?
One thing that was very different back in those days is that, talking to people of that time for my feature on Dahlin, I realized that every game there were two or three guys that were scratched that were younger players. I mean, you could have a whole line of rookies that were in the press box on any given day, which is something that today, when Arpin was asking you about maybe drawing a comparison between the way things can be dealt with today and how it was back then, it's not the sort of thing that when it comes to player development, you conceive today to have so many young players sitting out and not playing.
Yeah, I don't recall the rules of how many players we were allowed to keep. Was it 23 back then? Were you allowed more? I don't know. I don't really recall. And I know that the American League back then was an older league. Sometimes they didn't want to send their rookies there. They didn't want to send their rookies there because they didn't want them to get influenced by the veterans that are stuck down there that'll never get called up. And then, you know, go on these long bus rides, drink beer and all that. I'm serious. A lot of times they didn't want their young guys over there to be influenced by some of those guys over there. They would rather keep them here, work with them after the games, get them in the lineup here and there. I mean, unless there was a total that, you know, they totally agree that, he wasn't going to play. He really needs to go down there and play. But or else they kind of wanted to protect the young guys and keep them up. It was a different attitude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did the older players incorporate you guys into the group? Like, how does that, cause I think there's also, I've always been fascinated by this dynamic because you have young players coming in and they're talented, but if you're like in your mid 20s or late 20s, you see a young kid come in the room, you're like, this kid's coming after my job, right? Like, I mean, so how did that dynamic work on that team specifically?
Yeah, well, I have to say, you're right. I mean, as you get older, you're always, looking over your shoulder. That's my spot that someone's trying to take. And so you're fighting through it in training camp. A lot of it is, back in the day, even has to do with a contract. You're on a one way, you're kind of safe. That was the big thing, to sign a one way in our time, right? My first contract was a two way. It was actually a three way. It was 18. I get so much money for junior. And then as you go further, then after that, it was American League or NHL. But I think the middle of the pack guys, I think in those years you're talking about guys like Mark Hunter and even Ryan Walter was near the end of his career. Like these guys are coming in because Lucien Deblois, didn't play all the games, but he was still part of it. But maybe he couldn't handle 80 games. But Mario Tremblay got hurt that year. He hurt his shoulder, if I recall. So he didn't play. So I gave chance to Claude Lemieux, let's say, or to play on the right side. But the veteran guys like Bob and Larry and, even Bobby Smith and Mats Naslund, they knew, you need that young group to give you that energy. These guys are older. The grind of the 80 games and playing the game, you need the guy to get in there and dig in the corners and have that energy for you at times, to help the team. They realized it. They knew that, we're a bit raw. We used to jump over the boards and we were ready to go. I mean, when you're 19, 20, you're ready to scrap anything. You're playing in the NHL. You're ready to go. I was hopping on the ice. There was different times I would be playing with Richer and Claude Lemieux, and a lot of energy and obviously some sandpaper and some toughness and also some skill all combined. And then I could be thrown on the line with Shane Corson and John Kordick, when we go to Philadelphia. So, you know, we, and then we still had Nyland, obviously, out there. So, you know, we were a mix that we knew that we had to play certain ways, and some other places we had to play other ways. And if you wanted to stay in the lineup, you had to do it. And, but when we hopped over the boards, we were going 100 miles an hour. I mean, we were running guys and bringing that energy. And I remember Bob, you know, saying that's, you know, a couple of times, in some games, he says, that's great shift. You know, he'd come and tell us, that's great shift, guys. We needed that energy. We're half asleep or whatever. We needed that shift. We needed to change the momentum. So that's the encouragement you get from the old, veteran players. That, that, you know, he knew he wasn't going to lose his spot. He was still playing with Carbonell and Nyland, but, he knew that the team needed that little influx of energy and youth. And, so the guys that aren't afraid to lose that understand it, know that it's a good thing. But there's always two or three guys that are on their way out. And that always happens to all of us. I mean, as we get older, the same stuff happens to us, as we see near the end of your career. You know, I joke, I say, when you through your career, you go from the first to the second to the third to the fourth to the press box. You know, you're going from the first line all the way down. You go all the way down the line, and when you get to the press box, the next step is not a good one.
The next step is the broadcast booth.
Well, next step was Europe. I got to go to Europe for 4 years.
That's right. I hung in for another
4 because I finished at 32 and I still wanted to play. But you lose a little bit of a step, obviously, and you don't get another contract. But you know, I ended up getting another one in Europe. So that's a whole other story. It was also fun there too. It was different. It was interesting. It was a different brand of hockey, but it was Germany. I was in Germany and it was fun. We won a Spengler Cup over there. So there was a lot of stuff in my career that you go through and you kind of look back and, you know, there was a lot of different moments. You know, there was tough moments when I was in Toronto, and that's what I was saying. We were a team that really wasn't, gelling or doing much. And so it was, that was not a great time that year. That was a tough year to play, and getting a lot of heat in the you're talking about from the newspaper and from the fans and stuff like that. I took a lot of heat, and I actually said in the newspaper that I didn't play well. Like I actually said, you know, I've had a bad year and I'm not I haven't contributed and this and that. And I think the writer, I remember who the writer was. The writer said it was kind of refreshing for an athlete to admit that he wasn't playing well, because we're all easy to blame somebody else. And I admitted it. I said I didn't feel, when I got traded there from Vancouver, I was so disappointed from leaving Vancouver in the middle of the summer. I got traded there, and if you're not into playing for a team, like if you don't have the motivation, it really shows up on the ice, and I didn't really have it. And it showed. And I admitted it. I said I didn't have the motivation to play there, and it was strange, but it showed in my play.
You had plenty of enthusiasm and motivation when you played for Montreal. There's no doubt there. Probably more than when you later played after you were traded from Vancouver. But it's just, I wanted to go back to, because you were mentioning toughness. You mentioned Nyland and Cordic. Now you were still in juniors when there was this big brawl against Quebec. But you were with the Canadians for two of the famous brawls of the 80s, the other two big ones, the fight down the hall at the Boston Garden, and also the big brawl against Philadelphia during the playoffs in 87. Which one of those two would you say was the most memorable, or the one that really stuck with you the most, and why? If you've got some juicy details, because I remember we can see from the footage that the brawl in the hallway in at the Garden, you were there. You were really among those that that took part into this. But which ones stuck with you the most?
Well, the first one in Boston, I blame Nyland, of course, because he punched Lindsman. That's where it all started. That's when he had to go through the Boston bench to get to the dressing room. So every time we played in Boston, Knuckles did something that, you know, took us about 3.5 hours to play a hockey game. yes, I was down the hall. I went through the hall, and I was actually fighting with my skates in the hall in that brawl, and that was kind of strange to be in the Boston Garden in the hallway, fighting in the hallway with the skates, and we're, you know, your skates are scratching and we're falling. I don't even know who I was fighting with, but I remember, like, you know, there was the Boston police in there. The cops were there. They were trying to break it up. It was ridiculous. I couldn't believe it, you know, but when you're in the moment, you're going because you got full of adrenaline. And then you're like, when it's over, I'm like, what is going on here? What am I doing here? And we were all there, in the hallway, in the middle of this mess because of what happened where Nyland punched Lensman, and then the whole bench was there. So we had to kind of go through their bench to get through the hallway. That was kind of, I guess it was memorable. It's so funny. People tell me, I watched I have friends my age, you know, right? So I'm 21, I'm 22 years old, and I'm playing in Boston. I'm in this brawl, and my friends are telling me, I watched a brawl. That was awesome. That was amazing. That's so cool. And I'm going, no, it's not cool to be in a brawl. I said, it's actually very dangerous for one thing. I've been sucker punched before in a brawl, and you don't know where the punches are coming from. So it's actually very dangerous. And I said, yeah, it looks cool on TV, but it's not as cool as when you're in it. I said, the Philadelphia one, was strange, as we all know. That was in the warm up, and I would love to see if you guys can check out the roster of both teams before the game. I think Philadelphia probably had about 27 guys in warm up.
Oh yeah,
they had guys that were never going to play because now you're allowed an extra player, but they had three or four extra guys from Hershey back then that were all goons. And they had like Daryl Stanley and Ed Hospodar, guys that would never play. So I kind of wonder on that ball, that brawl, where, yes, I know that Corson and Claude Lemieux were stirring the pot by putting the puck in the net when everyone gets off the ice. And that was kind of a superstition. And Philly's superstition was the other way, not to have the puck go in. And that's, imagine starting a brawl because of that.
I know. That's,
I mean, when you think about it, it's so
but
crazy.
This is what I want. Did anyone tell those guys to stop doing that?
No.
No.
I don't recall after what happened. You right. know what? I don't really know what happened after, but I know that rules changed after that.
Okay.
For the better. But I will tell you a funny story. You know, because we all know that Claude Lemieux gets under everybody's skin. And there's a lot of times where we're not sure if he's actually hurt or not. And we all know the famous story with Pat Burns and all that. Yes. But during that time when we did the warm-up and we were all, I remember we were all in the dressing room, we're getting our stuff done, getting our stuff off. And I'm about to just maybe loosen up my skates a little bit after the warm-up, and you're getting ready for the, you know, it was a great series, Philadelphia, Montreal too. We were two good teams. And obviously the Flyers went to play on, to play against the Oilers in the finals, but so we're in the conference final, and as those guys are still on the ice, everybody is still, know that there's still a couple guys on the ice in Corson and Claude. And then all of a sudden we hear all this noise. Like, you can hear the fans making a lot of noise, and we're kind of wondering, what's all that noise about? And one of the guards came in the room, one of the security guards came in and started yelling and just, you know, came in the room. The coaches weren't there. They went into their coaches' room. We were just chilling, having a glass of water or a Gatorade. And then he comes in, he goes, somebody's, Ed Hospodar is beating the hell out of Claude Lemieux. And the whole room just stood still. It was quiet. I think we waited about 4 or 5 seconds, and then somebody said, okay, let's go. It's kind of like we kind of said, well, we'll let him get him a few shots. We'll let Claude get a few. Poor Claude. We were going out to defend him, but everybody kind of paused for about 5 seconds, and then everybody went on the ice. So it was kind of funny when we look back at it, but We got out there, and it was crazy. I mean, again, I don't know how many. It was interesting to know how many guys they had in warm up, because it seemed like they had two or three extra guys than we did in warm up, and that was kind of the style of the game in those days.
That was really intense, that one.
Yeah.
Jeez. Okay, well, Sergio, that was great. I knew that if we just got you on the phone, you would tell three or four great stories that'd be worth listening to, because you never disappoint in the press lounge before a game. But thanks so much for being on with us. It was great, and I hope to see you at a hockey rink at some point. That'd be fun.
Yeah, eventually we got to go back to work. Okay, my friends, take care, guys.
All right, thank you. Thanks for being here, man. Take care.
Okay, you got it.
Wow. So Sergio Mameso, always the awesome storyteller. It was great having him on. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I must say, Arpin, that since we're both from MDG, that Sergio's got his restaurant called Mameso's, serving one of the best submarines in town. And even despite the COVID-19 pandemic, his restaurant is still open for deliveries. So people from the area can call and get their sub. But it's just amazing. I was listening to him talking about those guys, Lemieux, Richer, Roy, Svoboda, all those guys, the crop of rookies that came in the mid 80s is just insane. It's, you know, we talk about the Trevor Timmins and his 2007 draft with Subban, McDonough and Pacioretty. Well, the 84 draft is really highly comparable, probably better even, in terms of significant draft in Canadians history. And even though Sergio was drafted the year before, he was really among that group that came in and assured that the team would surf a new wave.
You know, I think the reason I asked him about what the Canadiens are currently trying to do is because you look at that team. Patrick Roy was 19. Corson was 19, but he only played a handful of games. Sergio was 19. Svoboda was 19. Lemieux was 20, I believe. Richer was 19. I mean, it's just like these are players. You know, Shel Dahlin was 22. You know, Calder Trophy nominee that year. Even Mike McPhee was only 25, which I'm shocked because he's looked like he's 40 years old his whole career. Like in my mind, exactly. He always looks exactly. like he was 40, but he was only 25.
It's like when we talk about Lanny McDonald, I always say that McDonald was born at age 47.
Yeah, exactly. So, but like it's just an insanely young team, you know, and I understand Sergio's reluctance to compare the current group of prospects to the guys that he played with, because he's right. All of these guys went on to really long, successful NHL careers. But the principle of what the Canadiens are trying to do is largely the same. This is what they're hoping to accomplish, and they're hoping that they have this big group of players and that this group of players goes on to long and fruitful careers in the NHL. We just don't know that yet, but it obviously this was a far more like heralded group of young players at the time. Like people knew that there was some special things were going to happen, but you know, no one knew that Patrick Roy back then, that Patrick Roy was going to become this Hall of Fame goaltender, or that Claude Lemieux would become this historic playoff clutch performer and all that Stéphane Richer would become a 50 goal scorer. Like we didn't know at the time. We know now. So the Canadiens can only hope that, a similar group like this, maybe not a whole bunch of 19-year-olds, but still players coming in at 20, 21, and you know, adding that energy that Mameso talked about, that Bob Gainey told him that they provided. They're trying to do something similar, and they can only hope it can be half as successful as this group was. In hindsight, when we look back at this group 20 years from now or 30 years from now, maybe we'll be saying the same thing about some of the players that the Canadiens have drafted over the last 3 years. They gotta at least hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, a lot of that depends on player development, and that's something that we wrote about, you and I, in one of our latest articles on The Athletic this week, how the Canadiens have to make sure that they really use their farm team in Laval in a way that they haven't really done in the past. Partly because of the lack of quality prospects, but also because now they've got all the resources, you know, to attract like quality AHLers to surround those players. They've got the proximity with the home team, and it's really time for them to make full use of that farm team and that create that pipeline that so far, I mean, they've been talking about it for a few years now, but we feel like it's the fruit is almost ripe, because now you've got at least the starting the base ingredients to work with that crop of prospects. And today, the Canadians announced that they had signed Russian player Arsen Kisamutdinov to a 2-year entry level. I know.
That was well done.
Thank you. Yeah. So 2-year entry level, because he's an older guy. I think he was drafted at 21 or something. So, he's definitely someone who's going to help out, the Laval Rocket. I'm not sure if he's ever going to make it to the NHL, but he's got a good body, and, we'll see, how he does on the American, North American ice. But anyway, they've got those guys coming. So, We went in depth into thinking about how the Canadians could fully optimize their development, and making sure that they switched their philosophy a tiny bit in that regard.
Yeah, and so speaking of that, if you are listening to us on something other than the Athletic app, and you are not a subscriber to the Athletic, I just want to mention that if you want to read that story or any one of the other stories that we've done, that was the third of a 3-part series on sort of philosophical shifts. So you can now benefit from a 90-day free trial. So you just literally click on any story you find on The Athletic, and this offer will pop up where you can try The Athletic for free for 90 days. But if you don't want to take the 90-day free trial and want to get a 40% discount on your first year, you could do that today, right now, this second, by going to theathletic.com/athletic support, theathletic.com/athletic support, which is a 40% discount code for the listeners of this podcast. And you can jump on and read all the great stuff we're producing despite the lack of games right now. There's a lot of compelling reading going on The Athletic, and including, highlighted by our just 5-star coverage of the NFL draft and everything that's come out of there. So, if you haven't subscribed yet, please consider it. 40% off discount, theathletic.com/athletic support. But thanks for listening, and we will see you next week when we'll be back with Le Sport Athletic en français.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.